Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Mohammed Gamaldeen, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Yana Cummins about her new book, Community, Urban Health, and Environment in the Late Medieval Low Countries. Dr. Yana Cummins is assistant professor at the Department of Medieval History, Utrecht University. She defended her dissertation, cum laude, at the University of Amsterdam in 2018, and it was published in 2021 as Community, Health, and Environment in the Late Medieval Low Countries. Her research explores practices of various agents to promote communal well-being in pre-modern societies. She was part of the ERC-funded interdisciplinary project, Healthscaping Urban Europe, and currently works on her Veni Dutch Research Council project, Inflammable Cities, How Fire Risk Transformed the Low Countries, 1250 to 1600. Dr. Yana Cummins, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi.
It's so good to have you. Yana, I was wondering if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself. That is where you were born, raised, where you went to school, how you became interested in urban, medical, and environmental history, and whether you had a mentor or a scholarly work that drove your interest.
Yeah, thanks. I'm born in Utrecht, actually, so my most recent job is a sort of returning to that city, and grew up there, and then I wanted to study in a larger city, and there is only a few more larger cities, and one of them is Amsterdam, so I ended up there. This was not a very intellectually motivated decision, but I did really enjoy studying history and philosophy at the University of Amsterdam, and for a while followed many, many different types of courses, mostly on more recent history, but in the course of my master's, began to be more interested in the late medieval era. For all, I thought that was it was too hard to study medieval history because you had all these skills you had to have, such as the paleography in Latin. But after a while, I started to get into it. And there was one course, and actually it's still, I think, up to date, the only course on pre-modern public health that was given during my master's by Guy Geltner. And I followed that course and got very enthusiastic and decided to apply for a PhD project on medieval bathing culture and bathhouses. So that was my master's. And then during that, my PhD project was much broader and just basically asked in a very broad way what cities in the medieval period and especially the Low Countries did to prevent disease and promote health. And so a guy who was the first one introducing me to it has, I think, up to now been very influential and very encouraging for me to work with, because after my PhD, I did a postdoc in a project that was for which he was the PI. And I'm currently doing an edited volume on public health in the pre-modern world, so a more global approach, where he also joins. So if there's one person that really should be mentioned, it's him. And in this project that I've been part of as a postdoc for the past few years, there are also quite a few other people with whom I've worked quite intensively. So Claire Veda and Léa Hermenot are two important ones as well.
Very good. And I know Guy Gutner's work very well. His work in healthscape, and I can see its influence on your text. So that's fascinating to know that you studied with him. So my second question is, how did you come to write community, urban health, and environment in the late medieval Low Countries?
That's a very big question. I was from the, as I just mentioned earlier, from the beginning, very interested in a quite general question on how did cities or urban society prevent disease and promote, say, public hygiene. And started looking for sources, which is very tricky because it at this during this period, there's no, at least not for the Low Countries, there's no separate offices either on an urban or sort of proto-national level that delve with what we now call public health. So you really have to dig into local archives and find information in very various type of sources. So when I started doing that, one of the most obvious starting points were the many regulations, which you can basically find in any city, on public hygiene and, for instance, also on food quality and several other topics. So based on what I found in terms of what people at the time regulated and also in which they invested money, such as street paving or cleaners. So based on just what I found in the archives, I developed the idea that health or communal health could be divided into four sort of general programs. And these four programs have been have helped me structure my book. Maybe I should, I don't know, tell them right away what they are.
Yeah, why don't you, could you tell us what those, for the reader, for the listeners, what those four are?
Yes, sure. So these four programs, to summarize them very briefly, I think the first important one for pre-modern cities is to have investment and care for infrastructure, so both water and roads or land infrastructures. Secondly, really any city did not necessarily centralize waste collection, but did coordinate it, especially larger ones, but also smaller ones, just had some intervention with how waste was processed. And thirdly, very important for health and also very important in medical ideas is food and diet. So this you also see reflected in many ways in medieval cities. And finally, and this is maybe where public health diverges most explicitly from modern ideas, is that there's a very close connection between spiritual health and physical health. So to really understand a pre-modern vision of group health, you have to take that into account.
Very good. Thank you for that. And so we'll come back to some of these points through the questions. But first, Jana, I was hoping you could paint a picture for our listeners about the natural environment and urban settlement that make up the landscape of your case study in the Low Countries.
Yes, of course. It is quite a peculiar region in this period, or maybe, and still is, environmentally, because it's very wet and it's basically surrounded or founded on three major river deltas. So any larger city is connected to these riverways, which are extremely important for the supply for basically everything a city needs, some food and fuel to trade. But being so intertwined with the water landscape also comes with specific challenges, and that you see very clearly in how local societies sort of try to mitigate their environment. So waterworks have been extremely important. And there's also quite, as people know, it's a very flat region. So there's not many mountains or other, sort of large changes in the level of the land. So that gives opportunities, but is also, and these opportunities are partly connected to the water landscape. So there's a lot of, from very early on, say, even the early Middle Ages, there's a manipulation of the landscape, mainly by manipulating water. But it also creates a sort of continuous interaction with the landscape in that sense.
That's very true. And water plays a huge part in the development of these urban centers, as you've discussed. The next question. Your research uses a unique interdisciplinary methodology that ties in the environmental, the medical infrastructure, both freshwater and sewage, and the spatial. Specifically, you expand on the work around biopolitics. Could you tell the listeners about your theoretical framework?
Yes, I'll try to be as clear about it as possible, because it is a combination or kind of an alternative take also on a few of these key theoretical concepts. And I think indeed biopolitics is one of the most important ones. So biopolitics, as some listeners may know, is a term that has been, it already existed, but it's made famous by Michel Foucault, the philosopher, and it means slightly different things for different scholars, but generally it's about the idea that knowledge on health, on population in various ways, and on the environment is being integrated into the governance of people. And that is usually taken to be national states. But, and this is where my interpretation diverges from common sort of consensus, you don't really need a national state or modern techniques of monitoring health, such as statistics or modern medicine, to have to use that basic idea that the health of a population is part of the government, the governance of that population. So you can basically have biopolitics at any level, so from the very small local scale to the large national or empire scale. But on all these scales, biopolitics is negotiated by different actors, and there's always a connection between between the social and the political, and between the spatial and environmental. So that is very essential. So if you want to understand something as complex as public health, and I think this is also getting more and more important again, as we've seen during the COVID epidemic, that health is really about the interaction between environment, between what the daily routines of people, how we use space and medical ideas, and of course the relation between people and their governments and their willingness to obey to any regulations. So Yeah, so I think we've seen many, many biopolitical interventions ourselves during the epidemic. So that maybe make a little bit easier to imagine that biopolitics also existed in a different form, but in fairly similar ways many centuries ago.
That's very true. Thank you for that. You say in the introduction, waste management offers a window to investigate cities as a dynamic metabolic ecosystem. How is this so? And could you explain this for our listeners?
Yeah, so every society produces waste. Of course, pre-modern societies have different and arguably much less waste production. They're much more circular in their waste production than most Euro-American countries today. But nevertheless, there's always a metabolism of what a society uses or extracts from their environment and what it gives back in terms of waste and things, pollutants also into that environment. So, and you can investigate that for basically any society as long as you have some. And also you can investigate that on various levels. So here, archaeology, of course, plays an important role, and there's much to learn, even if you don't have any written sources. But if you do have a combination of sort of material evidence and written sources, it's clear that that there is a an urban metabolism. So there's sort of a circulation of matter in cities, and that people try to manipulate that circulation, and that is very key to environmental politics and also to communal health.
And I guess building on this, how does your work cross what you call conceptual divides that you describe that tend to separate animals, disease, and humans?
Yeah, it is something that I've become more and more interested in, to also look from a non-human, so more environmental but also animal perspective in my work, and it's very pertinent because it's clear that pre-modern cities were very multi-species conglomerate, so to say. So there were many animals in place, and some of them were clearly appreciated but also caused nuisance. And I think pigs and pig keeping is the most obvious example of that. So almost all households had one or two pigs that they fed and slaughtered when they needed the meat, but so many pigs in the cities also caused nuisances and stench, and also they wrecked roads or neighbors' orchards. So you see a lot of regulations about this, but this coexistence between animals and humans and in interaction with their natural environments or urban natural environments, if you may say so. If you start looking for it, there's actually quite much to be discovered, or it's quite clear that they're highly aware of both environmental factors and also the needs and challenges of animals within society.
Well, that's fascinating, because you see that over and over in different urban environments where animals are regulated to the outskirts or from the interior of urban sites, or from the interiors of domestic environments and pushed to the outside the city limits as part of like hygienic projects.
Yeah.
So animals and disease in this interaction with humans is a very fascinating way of looking at the urban environment, and I appreciate that work that you've done here towards that, as readers will see in a number of chapters.
And maybe to build on that, if we talk about animal disease, of course there's this the very famous and very influential idea that one of the most prevalent diseases in the late medieval period is a bubonic plague. So the Black Death is the most lethal epidemic in the mid 14th century, and the main idea or the main consensus now is that this is a bacteria that's located or it on fleas, and these fleas are being transported, so to say, by rats. So a lot of attention by scholars in the past decades have been on animals and specifically these rats. But if you compare that with the perception people at the time had, they're not at all really interested in rats, but they did connect a disease threat with many different things, but one was with certain animals, namely stray dogs. So you see that in the city, and of course this is also not entirely surprising because these dogs were a nuisance and sort of social politically problematic in different ways as well. But you see that once cities develop a sort of standard collection of measures against plague, that killing stray dogs is one of these measures that you see recurring in many cities. So they did make that sort of animal-human connection in disease as well.
Right, but in a very different way. And very that's different, fascinating. Yeah. My next question is about flows. Throughout the majority of your text, you highlight the centrality of flows and either its impediment for physical barriers or a need for smooth movement of air, water, urban space, peoples, and other areas. Additionally, this is very much connected to Galenism and the humors. Could you expand on the connections in these medieval cities and Galen between them, the city
yes.
and Galenism and flow?
Yeah, because it sounds like things that are quite far apart, but actually, in reality, yeah, it's quite connected. So if you talk about pre-modern ideas about health, that is a very fascinating mix of ideas from antiquity. And Galen is one of the most influential part of that is mixed with Arabic ideas and then Christian ones, and this collection of ideas on really how the world works and how basically it's basically just a theory about the cosmos it's really organic in its approach to both the environment, but also humans and animals, but also society. So the idea and health for all these different levels and for all these different entities is basically a balance that is not static, but that is being maintained by flow and by circulation. So in order to have a healthy body, you have to have a body that in which there's no blockage, in which everything flows or is circulated healthily. And so you think about the food and drinks and various forms of excretion, but also for society, health and healthy society is, and this is a very organic metaphor, is a society in which has a sort of dynamic balance in which everything flows. So there's no blockage. And for instance, stagnant water or blockage created by waste are very much a concern. So here you see that medical thought, in a very broad sense, informs thinking about health on various levels.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, that's very true. And it also trickles down, as we'll discuss, to even the individual, where they ingest these concepts and bring it into their own imaginary about what is healthy for their own domestic and environments. And when you discuss like latrines and its placement between neighbors, this idea of the neighbor or good neighbor. And also thinking about the interesting intersections with pre-existing medical theories globally, which is fascinating that all of these theories can intersect here in the Low Countries and trickle down to even the lowest individual.
Yeah, no, it is. It's really fascinating. It was also one of the main challenges because, it's hard sometimes to locate or really prove that people in a certain neighborhood or in a certain city had access or actually were aware of these quite elite theories. But in various ways, in ways of prescribing health or especially describing problems, you do see these ideas on flow, but also on the dangers of stench. Really see them in local archival sources reflected. So that was really one of the nice discoveries to make, that it is actually quite coherent and to see all these connections, so to say.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. The next question I had, in great detail, you describe the various individuals, regulations, and governances that worked in tandem to produce a hygienic city. For example, how did the market inspectors' duties differ based on location and regulation and attention paid to hygiene in that urban context? And how did all these institutions help create an imaginary around hygiene? And one way that we will see play out is between individuals on the domestic level.
These are two quite nice examples. So I'll try to discuss them both. So if you look at markets and so food markets, they have how do you say it? So these food markets, they're usually centralized in one space, and one of the reasons that they centralize is obviously socio-political. So there's a certain group with certain privileges that gets to sell, for instance, meat or raw meat in a nice building. But it also helps to check or to supervise the quality of meat that's being sold there. And here, these market inspectors is an office that you can find in many, many cities in the Low Countries and elsewhere. And you see that these market inspectors, for instance, for meat, have a very clear idea on how, on how do you say that, on disease risks and also how long a meat stays well. And they usually have different limits of time for the summer and the winter. So here you really see medical ideas applied to a very concrete context. And also, they usually inspect the animals beforehand. So there's also the whole trade in animals and how they are handled within the city that is also involved in this. But another part of the city that is usually not very visible, but you can find in court records, is the negotiation of health and nuisance by neighbors. And that's because when cases escalate, for instance, about shared hygienic infrastructures, which were very common, so people usually shared a well for fresh water, but also latrines or cesspits, and that usually went well. And but sometimes when a new homeowner arrived or otherwise changes were made, also to houses, you see that the tensions can really escalate, and sometimes you find them before the urban court. So here you, this is a sort of entrance to see how hygiene was negotiated at the very micro, local, or domestic level. And it's clear that people really cared. So they're very eager to secure, to avoid stench or also deterioration of their homes, and to have access to fresh water and to waste or to means of disposing their waste.
And this connects nicely to my next question, about about the social history you do in these court archives. And I'd like you to expand more about the centrality of the court archives to your study and how you sifted them for evidence related to hygiene and health. And in particular, there is also this class element that you bring up, that, you know, that this is due to access, it's probably not a good idea about the entirety of society, but it gives us a view into a number of court cases and situations from various levels of society. Could you speak more about the court documents as a source and what type of narratives they offer to you, as you've already discussed briefly?
Yeah. Thanks. I think that's one of the at least the nicest things that I really enjoyed researching these court narrative, although it was quite hard to find cases, so it was also quite labor intensive. Because when you start researching health, and you usually find a regulation. So these are issued by the governing elite. And that gives you two challenges or problems. First, their rules. So you know very little about their enforcement or about practices. And second, it's a very elite perspective. And as you, increasingly discovered, it's also quite a narrow spatial focus. So these elites are very interested in the flows, so to speak, of a specific sort of a spatial network of key nodes in the city. And that leaves a lot of the city and many parts or many social groups largely outside your vision. So, and if you go to court records, there are two types. So generally, criminal records. So these are investigations instigated by governments. But there's also, from very early on, in huge volumes, what we now call civic litigation. So just people having a conflict with each other and going to either a notary or a urban court to put into writing either their fight or their conflict, or sometimes also a solution. And if you sift through these type of civic court records, you find arguably not the lowest levels of society because it did cost something to initiate a court case. Actually, that's one of the things that people use as now to pressure their neighbors, for instance, into action. So a lot of times you don't really see what happens in the end. You just see the initiation of a case. But arguably, there's a lot of what you say, like middle class and more, yeah, normal kinds of residents that are active. And therefore, you can see what these type of people, how their environment looked like. And for me, it was interesting to see that they did have all kinds of hygienic infrastructures, but also thought really carefully about light in their house, about, or for instance, complained about the chimney of the neighbor being too low, and therefore they suffered more air pollution than necessary. So there's quite a few issues that relate to health that you can reconstruct based on these type of sources. And also, for instance, quite a few women are also very active, such as widows, who then have these tasks as head of households, who also come to these courts. So it's quite varied and interesting to see.
Oh, agreed. And I was very excited to see them and read them. Now turning to probably one of the more important medical issues of the medieval period is plague. Yeah. You write that we should study responses to plague in the broader context of ongoing preventive health practices, challenges, and not solely at points of crisis or through the elites of the era. Essentially, a top-down approach to studying plague. Yeah. Instead, it should be, as you say, decentralized. Could you expand on this point? But also, could you speak some on studying plague through the frames of biopolitical, environmental, and civic?
Yeah. So there's plague. It's a huge research field, and but actually that research field has been very advancing in the past decades because of new techniques. So we know much more about the actual bacteria or the strains of bacteria that causes plague. So this is very active. But what I found that was, at least for the region that I'm studying, quite lacking is sort of more up-to-date ideas about the social political responses to plague. And indeed, as you mentioned, so to move away from just these sort of elite interventions and to really look at plague measures or what people did to avoid the spread of plague can be put in a context of much more routine care for the environment and for sanitation and hygiene. And this is a point that's been fairly much overlooked because people initially assumed that public health started, and this is a point Guy Geldner has also made for Italy, people usually assumed that public health started after Macbeth. So it started at the moment when a terrible epidemic hit. But it's very clear that even before that and afterwards, outside context of epidemic, sort of care for public health was present in urban governance and politics. So in that sense, integrating plague into biopolitics means integrating this specific threat or health risk in a broader political landscape or social political landscape that mitigates health risks.
No, exactly. And so what you're doing is countering this narrative, and what other scholars have done as well, plague scholars, is countering this narrative as the plague as a watershed moment,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And that there was no public health initiative in these urban environments, and it was a moment of crisis that forced them into action.
Yeah, that woke everyone up, whereas before they were sleeping. Yeah. So that was the main. Correct.
Right. And so your work works into this larger discussion of urban health that got together, and other scholars like Nukhet Varlik in the Ottoman Empire have discussed, and like the development of public health policies prior to these epidemics. And so it's fascinating to see the trajectory in your text about the growth of public health and its socio-medical aspects to it, which you do really well here.
Thanks. It is. And it's for me also, because initially my PhD didn't have a chapter on the plague at all. But I was, as I was writing the book version during, so in 2020, it just occurred to me that it was quite necessary to reflect on plague separately in a chapter. And I do still think that I just see beyond quarantine, which is a very obvious example of a measure that is both at the moment being used and was used in a highly similar way in the late medieval period. There's just so much things that you can learn or are very insightful when we just think about the fact that to fight an epidemic, the medical or scientific ideas are really a relatively small component of a much broader biopolitical effort that has to be made. And here, the relation between state and its subjects, between environment and sort of flows or spatial politics is so important. And I think we can see it at the moment. And it's that's very much true also when we have, when we're studying epidemics of the past.
For sure. I agree 100%. If I may track back a bit to how the research came together, could you discuss the various sources you used and the archives that made this text possible?
So I tried to combine a few things. So I didn't want to sort of cherry picking a little bit of everything kind of study. But I also, because it's the first comparative study for this region on this topic, I also didn't want to restrict myself to, say, two case studies and therefore not be allowed to include other things I found for other cities as well. So what I did is a sort of core satellite construction, excuse me, and which means that I have selected three cities in which I have done in-depth archival research, and I combined that with what else was available easily for other cities. So if they had a nice published series of, say, accounts or court records, I took a look at those and try and see if I try if I could incorporate some of that evidence as well. But so for these three case studies and the archival work there, for each of them, there was a combination of rules, of court records, as I mentioned earlier, and of financial administration. So I don't know if it's very typically Dutch, but these cities were very meticulous in administrating their income and their expenses. So there's, it sounds very, sounds a bit boring, but because it's just very dry lists of things, but you can get so much practical information out of these financial records on public works, on the hiring of officials, on sort of miscellaneous expenses that is very interesting to compare that with what you know is the ideal in regulations. So, and that is sort of combining these sort of layer of types of knowledge for each city and then comparing the cities was sort of, that was sort of the general idea.
That was very fascinating. And the comparative here worked really nicely between the three cities. They say both, they all three have different population numbers and have growth at different times than one another. So they gave a good window into late medieval Low Countries. So to conclude, if I may ask you, what are you working on, Jana?
So at the moment, I'm working on a few things. So together with Lea Hermenot, as part of the Healthscaping project, I am mapping public works. So we try to really see what spatial impact or environmental impact investments in all kinds of material structures and infrastructures in the city had. So that's a sort of an article project. And recently, I've been awarded with a research grant for a larger project, which is on the fire and fire prevention. And that really comes directly out of this research, because when going through all this archival evidence, one thing that kept coming up in large amounts were sources about fire risks and regulations, as well as all kinds of subsidies, for instance, for fire safe building. So and the risk of fire seems to have been sort of forgotten a bit, because it is now not such an environmental threat in, say, your modern American cities. But the way this risk is mitigated in society, I think, has very interesting parallels with the energy transition or the climate crisis that we are currently experiencing, in terms of who is able to affect change, a change that everyone recognizes is good or necessary, but it's very costly and very hard to realize. So it is still about well-being, but on this very specific topic.
Very fascinating. I can't wait to see your next work, and looking out for both of those works, especially one on fire. Sounds fascinating, because it does offer a good lens into urban regulations, health, hygiene, and materiality of the built environment.
So. Yeah. And maybe also disasters, and because I've been also more and more in, because disaster studies is, as you may know, the environmental environmental scholarship is a major a field, but I like to approach it from this more sort of routine or the more continuous care for urban environments. I think there's a very sort of interesting connection there.
Definitely. Jana, it was a pleasure. I thank you for spending time with myself and the listeners discussing your text, Community, Urban Health, and Environment in Late Medieval Low Countries. It was a pleasure learning more about your work and your research and how it was made.
Thank you. And thank you for having me and for reading the book so carefully. It's been a real pleasure.
Jana, pleasure was all mine. Thank you, Jana.